Okay. Well, again, good evening. Welcome to the latest installment on the creation science class. We're going to be talking about comparative embryology tonight. Fun stuff. So, before I get rolling, there's a couple of things I wanted to work through just to summarize some of the things we talked about last week, specifically in relationship to the DNA structure and how each of the parts are related from genes, or DNA and chromosomes and genes and nucleotides and all that stuff, and how they're organized. So I'm going to use the board, and for anybody that's online, I apologize because you can't see it, but that's all right. I'll go ahead and just give you a quick run through so we have a better understanding of this. And I'm not going to get too much into the details in relationship to the individual structures within, and the differences between, say, a karyote and a eukaryote and all those kinds of things. I'll just kind of give you the basics. I don't think I did a very good job of explaining it last time, so I want to start and do that now. So a couple of things about the structure of DNA, and this is going to be important as we talk about some of the predictions and some of the probabilities that we'll talk about at the end of the class today, so I want to make sure that you have the information. Okay, so DNA is, of course, a double helix structure. Okay, so I'm going to draw a couple of things here. This, for those of you who might not be able to see this, this is a P. It's a square with a P, and that's a phosphate. And then you have a sugar. Okay, so you have a phosphate molecule and a sugar molecule. Okay, and you have another sugar molecule here, and another phosphate molecule here. Between the this is called the sugar phosphate backbone, and that's each side of the double helix, each strand. If you want to talk about it from a perspective of a ladder, it's the sides of the ladder. Okay, and so you have a sugar phosphate backbone, and as you continue down the line here, it always goes like this: sugar phosphate. Yeah, you get the point. I can't draw. So it always alternates like this: sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate. Okay, and then on the sugar molecules is where you will have the nucleotides, and the nucleotides are your. Of course, now my marker's not working. Are your adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine. Okay, those are your nucleotides. Those are the alphabet of the genetic code. And of course, adenine, I always list them that way, but they shouldn't be listed that way. It's always adenine and thymine always go together. Okay? And then you always have, in the other side, cytosine and guanine. And if you can't see it very well, but they always make the connections on the sugar portion of the sugar phosphate backbone. Okay? So, the nucleotides, of course, here, these are complementary base pairs, so they always form A and T and C and G. They don't necessarily have to be A on this side and T on that side and C on that side and G on that side. They can alternate, but they always have, that's the only way that they join together. Okay? A couple of other things about chromosomes. Remember, there are 46 chromosomes, 23 pairs in the human being. This is in a, it's called a karyotype. It's K-A-R-Y-O-T-Y-P-E, karyotype. And basically what a karyotype is it's a picture of all of the chromosomes within the human body or within an organism. And that's where you can see them lined out with the pairs. Okay, so in a eukaryotic cell, a eukaryotic cell is one that has a nucleus. And in a nucleus, you'll have DNA strands that are made up of these pairs of nucleotides that are wrapped around a protein in a straightforward karyotic cell. You won't have DNA wrapped around protein, just for your information. Okay, so basically all chromosomes are is they're just long strings of DNA, long strings of these nucleotides joined together. And as if you were to take the example, I guess it would be if you were to take a ladder and you twist it up, the ladder doesn't stay the same length. As you twist it up, it gets shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, until eventually what you have is a spiral, and I'm just going to draw the one. Actually, I can draw the two if I do it this way. What you get is a spiral that essentially gets very, very tight, very, very tightly wound. So it's able to condense a tremendous amount of information. And then what happens at this point is that it wraps around a protein and then gets smaller, and then it begins to form what we recognize as chromosomes. And so then the next question might be, well, what is a gene itself? Well, all a gene is it's a sequence of these nucleotides. And most genetic sequences, most sequences of nucleotides that form genes, take up to about 870 genes that's 870 genes per chromosome. There's about 120,000 genes in terms of genetic sequences within the human body. There's a lot of them. And one of the things I mentioned last week that I want to make sure I clarify, because I know I did not answer this question very well. When you're looking at a karyote, when you're looking at the structure of the DNA when it's broken, or the chromosomes, and you might have a couple pairs. Well, of course, when you get down to the bottom, you always have an X and a Y. You have a what would be an X and what would be a Y. And really what happens is that the Y chromosome is the one that's that determines that the organism is going to be male, in a human being anyway. And one of the things that I mentioned last week is that it's not like you can take out one segment of chromosomes and have a nice clean set of instructions that always do the same thing. In a way, that's right, but in others, it's not. And the reason I say that is because a fairly small portion of each individual chromosome and a very small portion of all of our genes actually produce proteins, and that's what DNA is for. It's for producing protein. So while these by themselves, we know, for instance, where mutations or where diseases occur, we can identify them genetically by which chromosome they happen in. So like chromosome 7, we know what chromosome 7 does. We know the instructions that it has. But what I'm saying is that it's not like if you take chromosome 1 and 2 out that you won't have an arm. It's not like that. It's not that neat. It's not like, you know, you take chromosome 2 out and you don't have a left leg. It's not like that. It's the instructions that are coded there function across many parts of the body. For instance, the last two chromosomes, the X that determine sex, have a lot to do with the rest of the functions in the body, obviously, especially when you start looking at the sex that's determined by these chromosomes. So I just want you to understand that these instructions that are here, they're very complex, of course, but they're not like, it's not like this is for left arm and that's for the right arm and that's for the foot. It's not like that. Okay? All right. As I mentioned, there are approximately 870 genes per chromosome. So approximately 870 patterns of DNA in each chromosome. Okay? All right, just wanted to clarify all that so that if I missed, wanted to correct it. All right, so let's go ahead and talk about comparative embryology tonight. This is another aspect to homology. It's, again, comparative sciences. And as the name implies, embryology is the study of the embryo. Okay? So in Origin of Species in 1859, Darwin asserted that similarity among the various embryos of animals and man was a primary proof of the theory of evolution. In another book that he wrote in 1871 called The Descent of Man, Darwin devoted the entire first chapter to this line of evidence. So in 1859, he said, embryonic development will prove, in his words, to be a large source of information or a large proof of evolution. Okay, so it's going to be very valuable in terms of his theory. In 1871, the entire first chapter of his book was devoted to this very subject. And he stressed how critical it was to the success of the theory. Now, with this very confident assertion that embryology provides proof of evolution, comes a great deal of necessity to prove that assertion. So when he made this statement saying, hey, this is really important, this is going to provide the evidence and the proof that we need, as you can imagine, there's quite a bit of pressure to come up with this answer. Now, as we'll see, the truth of the matter is that this assertion is entirely false. And the so-called proof that is provided in comparative... Oops, sorry. I knew that was going to happen the second I threw it there. Thank you. The proof that's provided in many biology textbooks is based upon the lie of a man bent on the support of Darwin's evolutionary theory. This man, his name is Ernest Heinrich Haeckel. 1839 to 1919 is when he lived. He was known as the disciple of Darwinism in Germany. He taught at the University of Jena in Germany. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. But he popularized the theory of embryonic recapitulation, or, as he referred to it, the great biogenetic law. I remember way back when we talked about cosmology, we talked about the law of biogenesis, which means that, or says, that life has to come from life. Okay? So he's basically taking that, I thought it was rather interesting, and changing it slightly, and saying it's the biogenesis. This is not the same thing as the law of biogenesis, and the law of biogenesis is true. It is a law. Now, Haeckel suggested that the successive stages of human embryonic development repeat the evolutionary stages of our animal ancestry. Look on Dave's face. What? So, in other words, what he's saying is that in utero, from the time that the egg is fertilized and starts to divide, it goes through all of the evolutionary stages that mankind supposedly went through in our goo-to-you evolutionary theory. Okay? Now, of course, there's some problems with this, but Haeckel suggested that these successive stages repeat that developed. It's called ontogeny. $5 word for you there. Basically, all that means is ontogeny means that the development of one. Recapitulates means repeats. And phylogeny means the development of species or groups. So, in other words, the development of one of the species. So, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Great word for you, or words. So, in other words, the human embryo passes through all the stages representing its ancestors, from the one-celled stage to the human. Seeing a human embryo grow, then, would therefore be like watching a silent moving picture of our ancestral heritage, of our evolutionary ancestral heritage, anyway. Okay. So, with Ernest Haeckel, he was an accomplished artist, and to illustrate his findings, he develops very detailed drawings of embryos at three different stages of development. So here's a model of, or here's the drawings that he made. How many of you have ever seen this before? I mean, outside of this class? Okay. Yeah, in school. Now, what year did you graduate high school? I don't mean to put you on the spot. 92. I graduated in 94. I saw it. Yeah. 75, you said? So... I know how old you are, Sue. But anyway, I saw this in biology in high school. I didn't think anything of it. I thought, hey, this is great. This information, look at that. It's cool. You see the little gill slits there. I wonder if we can ever get back to that. You know, I don't know. Whatever. So you see it. At any rate, so starting from these are plates that he made. So starting from the left to the right, you can kind of see it at the bottom there, but I'll read it for you, and it's in German. So on the left, on the very far left, it's a fish, and then it's a salamander, and then a tortoise, a chick, a hog, a calf, a rabbit, and a man. So these are from the plates that he made. and they're, just for information, they were made in 1876. The plates are labeled 6 and 7. So, and 6 and 7. So these specific plates were made by Haeckel. They illustrated what he referred to as evidence of his theory of embryonic recapitulation in what he called rudimentary gill slits that harkened back to the human's evolutionary stage as a fish. Notice the folds beneath the eye in the what you can call the neck area in all of those, specifically in the first one. And then you can see on that on the top row, you can see those slits pretty obviously. And then as you go down that first column to the left, of course, you see that it ends up being a fish and still, of course, has the gill slits. Now, this is something that, again, I remember hearing about all the time. I remember this. I remember writing, putting answers down on biology tests about the different stages of where human beings lost their gill slits and where they lost their tail. I mean, just all I can remember all this. Yes.
You gave it away?
Yeah. Yeah, they say that they're gill slits, and one of the things that we'll talk about is what are they? What are they? Are they really truly gill slits? Well, certainly looking at that, there's not a lot of a difference between all those critters up there, but we'll get to the bottom of this. So, Haeckel's drawings and his terminology are still used today in many high school and college biology textbooks. They are used to describe the development of embryos and as a basis for evolutionary teaching and as a basis for the fact that, well, we do go through these stages. Now, they're careful, and my research on this, it's been a couple years, I'll admit, maybe they've changed it. The last time I looked into this, they were careful not to necessarily say that Haeckel's theory was 100% accurate. They just say that based upon his research, we've been able to develop new understandings of embryonic growth and the stages of development, obviously in reference to our supposed evolutionary past. This theory, as I mentioned, is still prevalent in the media. So here magazine, a story from 2002, November 11, 2002, it detailed what were at the time the latest findings in human fetal development. Juxtaposed between the illustrations and the article were the photo captions that contained references to this concept of ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. So in this article here, they're, as they're talking about and as they're showing all these different references, they'll show an item or an example, something like this, and say you can see the development of gill slits. It refers to this something that was called ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, etc., etc. So they use these terms. So stage 14 here, just to give you an example, this is approximately 32 days after fertilization. This is the quote from Time magazine. It says, "The brain is a labyrinth of cell-lined cavities, while the emerging arms and legs still resemble flipper-like paddles," making very sure to reference some sort of amphibious creature. The next one here, at 40 days, stage 17, a human embryo looks no different from that of a pig, chick, or elephant. All have a tail, a yolk sac, and rudimentary gills. Okay, this is 2002. Okay. So, Time magazine, of course, they know what they're talking about. They never tell you anything but the truth, so we should just accept it and move on, right? Well, let's keep moving through this. The article itself presented a marvelous, and this is their word, miraculous, seemingly miraculous, vastly complicated embryonic process. But the glossy pictures that accompany the article, the ones that are remembered by the readers, painted a much different picture. They instead portrayed a slideshow of human evolution from single cell to human and made the argument that the process was no different in other mammals. In other words, basically what they were saying in the article and through the images is that, now, honestly, a lot of people when they pick up a Time magazine or a National Geographic, what do they look at? The pictures. And you'll read the headings. And the headings are what, the picture and the headings are what you're going to remember, most people. Unless you really read into those, unless you're, you know, really curious about it. Most people are just going to look at the pictures. What they got from the pictures, if you don't even read the article, just look at the pictures, is that every mammal goes through this process. It's just the human beings go a little bit further. Okay? That's what their point was, they were trying to get across. So, what's our response? to this, this evidence of evolution, Ernest Haeckel's drawings and Time magazine's information? Well, thankfully, our job is actually relatively easy, because by as early as 1932, and I know none of us graduated high school before 1932, as early as 1932, Haeckel's theory was shown to be a complete and total lie. It was fabricated. But yet I learned about this in high school. Okay? So, it's, as I mentioned, it's nothing more than lies. And Sir Arthur Keith, he had this to say about embryonic recapitulation. He said, "It was expected that the embryo would recapitulate the features of its ancestors from the lowest to the highest forms in the animal kingdom. Now that the appearances of the embryo..." skip the next one here. "Now that the appearances of the embryo at all stages are known, the general feeling is one of disappointment. The human embryo at no stage is anthropoid in appearance. The embryo of the mammal never resembles the worm, the fish, or the reptile." What did he have? What did Haeckel have in his drawings? He had a fish and a reptile. And mammals, of course, but said that they all look the same. "Embryology provides no support whatsoever for the evolutionary hypothesis." The emphasis is mine. This was written in 1932. Okay? And we know similarly much more about it now than we used to. So, let's explain this a little bit. Let's talk a little bit more about this. So, Haeckel was an accomplished artist, as I mentioned. He used his artistic talent to falsify certain areas of the drawings that accompanied his scientific articles. One writer summarized the matter as follows. To support his theory, however, To support his theory, however, Haeckel, whose knowledge of the embryo was self-taught, faked some of the evidence. He not only altered his illustrations of embryos, but also printed the same plate of an embryo three times, and labeled one a human, the second a dog, and the third a rabbit, to show their similarity. This was written in 1977. I mean, he faked some of his evidence, and he altered the illustrations, and he copied them and said that they were what they weren't. Haeckel even went so far as to alter his colleagues' drawings, including the famous embryology professor L. Rudemeyer of the Basel University and Professor Arnold Bass. The two university professors, after realizing what Haeckel had done, publicly condemned his actions. In the end, as H.H. Newman of the University of Chicago put it, Haeckel's works did more harm than good to Darwinism. He said that in 1932. So, why are we still learning about this as scientific evidence for evolution? Why are we still referencing it in a Time magazine article, although not directly, still used his catchphrase, "Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny," still used it in the article written in 2002. Why are we still learning about it then? It's the Communist Manifesto. There you go. Because there's an agenda. The agenda is ultimately to destroy any kind of belief in the Bible, any kind of belief in anything related to a religion that isn't based upon worship of man. Okay? And that's, you know, totally my opinion, but I think it's relatively makes sense. So, his drawings were published around 1866, discredited around 1932. And despite this, one of Haeckel's major points remains ensconced in evolutionary literature. It's interesting, one of the major points that he stressed in his research, and one of the items that has remained ensconced in evolutionary literature, is the idea that the human embryo possesses gill slits that are leftovers, from its past fish-like ancestor stage. So, this is what we were talking about a little bit earlier, that gill slits, according to them, that these gill slits are leftovers from our development as fish, or from fish. Well, from 1957, evolutionist Irvin Adler, in his book How Life Began, quite a statement, wrote, "The embryo of each species seems to repeat the main steps by which the species developed from the common ancestor of all living things. All mammal embryos, for example, pass through a stage in which they have gills like a fish, showing that mammals are descended from fish-like ancestors." Wait a minute, didn't we talk about this? Wasn't this discredited in 1932? Yet, it's still there in evolutionary mindset. So, fast forward almost 50 years to the 21st century, in an educational, I'll call it an indoctrinational program, produced in 2001 by the University of Chicago for its Newton Electric Community Division, Newton Electronic Community Division, the following statements appeared. All mammals have gill slits in their very early fetal development, 2001. Still there, still being taught. So to sum up, Haeckel falsified his drawings of the embryo to support his theory. So what are these gill slits? Well, really all the gill slits are folds of flesh that later develop into the various parts of the neck region. They never function like the breathing organs of fish. This came from 1973. So the gill slits, even though they're still taught as being these folds, still being taught as gill slits, in 1973 they made that pretty clear, that this is not at all what it was. They developed different bones in the neck, and they do develop parts of the, my understanding is, parts of the support structure for the shoulders. So they never, these folds of flesh, never function as gill slits. Never. Proven in 19, or at least shown to be true in 1973. So, as I mentioned, Haeckel falsified his drawings of embryos to support his theory. And a bit more research here from 1965. The human embryo does not have any differentiated gill tissue, and the gill-like pouches do not have open gill slits as in fishes. Fins are lacking. The tail is not at all like any fish's tail. Indeed, the resemblance to an adult fish is vague and superficial. 1965. So, the authors of this article later conclude that it is now firmly established that ontogeny does not recapitulate phylogeny. George Gaylord Simpson and William Beck wrote that in 1965. So they knew this in 1965. They knew it way earlier, but took science 30 years to catch up. So to sum up, Haeckel did falsify his drawings to support his theory. Remember the intense pressure that would have been put on him and on the evolutionary mindset to come up with answers for this? Guess what? They came up with answers for it. They made it up. Yeah, and they can do that today too, unfortunately. I think we have a lot more poorly educated people than ever before. But he altered the drawings of some of his colleagues, as I mentioned, and his theory is still present in modern-day high school and college biology textbooks. Now, this is interesting because a couple years ago, well, it's about 5-6 years ago now, when I, in a former career, one of the ladies that I worked with, her husband is a biology teacher in one of the public schools in Yellowstone County, and so me, being who I am, it had a little interesting conversation with him and started talking about Ernest Haeckel and asking him what he thought about his drawings and his contributions to evolutionary theory. And at first, I don't think he knew who I was talking about until I made reference to the plates and the drawings. And oh, yeah. He's a biology teacher, right? So we keep talking and talking and talking. I said, did you know that his work was found to be utterly false in 1932? Oh, well, and it basically started accusing me of, which I did, of baiting him, which I did. But the point was, is that he was surprised that I knew, but he knew that his information, that Haeckel's information for the most part, had been falsified. And he's a high school biology teacher. Not usually, no. Not in public education. Yeah. And that's why things like Common Core is so dangerous. that's a whole other subject, but that's why public education is what it is. And ultimately, public education is supposed to be controlled by the parents and the school board, and there's, yeah, right, good luck with that one. That ended with, well, George Bush. So, yeah, I think that final nail in the coffin was George Bush, and then George W. carried it on. So, anyway, so this teaching is still prevalent in high school today, and in college, I would imagine that they talk about it as well. I would hope that in college they have some sort of a discussion around what Hinkle actually did. I would hope. I don't know. But his theory is still very popular in college and in textbooks today. So let's move on to talk about a couple of other things. We're going to talk about something called irreducible complexities and some probabilities involved with what we've been talking about. So Darwin's theory of gradual evolution by natural selection is heavily dependent upon the observation of already existing biological systems for proof. Okay? So remember, Darwin looked at something that had already existed. You know, look at the finches in the Galapagos Islands. He looked at all the different kinds of finches. They already were an existing system. And then he based his system on working backwards from there. And at the time of his observation, and at the time of his writing, with the technology available to him and other scientists, the evidence for a common ancestor as illustrated between differing species seemed to be the most logical answer outside of a creator. Now, it's interesting to note that Darwin was actually trained as a priest. So, and that's a whole other story. But anyway, what Darwin and his contemporaries could not have known was that behind the relatively superficial examinations they made was a world of enormously complex, finely calibrated, miniature biologic machines controlling all functions of life. Without the aid of immensely powerful microscopes, Darwin was left to assuming that the things too small for him to see were simple and therefore unimportant. Little did he know that the very things he considered unimportant ultimately unravel his theory. So the things he could not see are the things that unravel his theory completely. Now, nearly 150 years after Darwin's book, we can safely say that this theory has been reduced to fantasy in the exact manner he predicted when he wrote this. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. What we will examine today is two examples of just that sort. Complex organs or systems that could not have possibly developed over time through random mutation and natural selection. So we're going to talk about irreducible complexity. It's kind of a fun subject. An irreducibly complex system is something that is unable to be reduced to a simpler form and still function. Michael Behe, in his book Darwin's Black Box, originally published in 1996, explains what is meant by the term irreducible complexity. He says that it is a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. These irreducibly complex systems are found everywhere in biology, and they show just how wonderfully and fearfully made we all are, and all of life. So, to illustrate the concept of an irreducibly complex system, I'll give you a really simple example. A mouse trap. Or in this case, a trap for rats. So, the purpose of a mouse trap or a rat trap is to catch rats or mice, right? That's what they're made for. The purpose is to catch a mouse and to keep it from being able to chew on the things and leave remainders and reminders of its presence. It's there to catch it and kill it. The most common form of a mousetrap is several simple parts that work together to accomplish the trap's purpose. You have a flat wooden base or a platform, a metal hammer, which crushes the mouse and kills it eventually, a spring with extended ends to press against the base, and the hammer when the mouse trap is charged, a sensitive catch that releases when slight pressure is applied, a metal bar that holds the hammer back when the trap is charged, and of course assorted staples to hold the system together to the base. So in essence, the simple mouse trap is an irreducibly complex system because each of the parts are listed above and mentioned here in the diagram need to be present and working properly in order for the trap to function. If any one of these parts are removed, missing, or faulty, the mouse trap ceases to function. So you can't remove any of the pieces on that and still have a functioning mouse trap. It's an irreducibly complex system. And there really are only, what, 6 parts to that? If you count the staples as one part, there's really only 6 pieces to all that. So, in a lot of ways, it's actually very simple. So, let's talk about one that's a bit more complex. Let's talk about the bacterial flagellum. The bacterial flagellum is a wonderful example of an irreducibly complex system found in some bacteria, and it is a swimming device that allows the bacteria to swim around in its environment. The bacterial flagellum functions as a rotary propeller, much like you would find on a boat. The structure of the bacterial flagellum is amazingly complex and contains many moving parts and requires the presence of over 40 proteins in order to function. So there's over 40 different components required for this particular thing to function. So the flagellum itself is a long, hair-like filament embedded in the cell membrane. The external filament consists of a single type of protein called flagellin. The flagellin filament is the paddle surface that contacts the liquid during swimming. So that's that blue hair that you see sticking out there. Okay? That's the whip, essentially. That's what the propeller. At the end of the flagellum filament near the surface of the cell, there is a bulge in the thickness of the flagellum. It is here that the filament attaches to the rotor drive. So you see that the hook or the universal joint there, and then it connects down into the internal portions of the device or of the mechanism called the rotor drive. The attachment material is comprised of something called hook protein. The hook portion of the filament uses a bushing method to pass through the cell wall. Connected to the hook and passing through the bushing is a rod or drive shaft of the propeller. The rod connects to the motor that contains both a straighter, or a non-moving part, and a rotor, a moving part, plus many other supporting proteins. The bacterial flagellum is composed of many parts that are required for it to function. This is an irreducibly complex system. Gradual evolution, by the process of random mutations and natural selection and minuscule changes over time, cannot explain the existence and much less the development of the bacterial flagellum and of the many intricate parts involved in this particular device. There's a video we're going to watch a little bit later on, and many of you have probably seen it. It's called Unlocking the Mysteries of Life. Yes, how many of you have seen that one? Okay, so we will watch it. It's fantastic, and actually this is where the screenshot comes from, and they do a very good job of explaining it, but this is an amazing piece of machinery. This is essentially what we build in outboard motors. But nobody would look at an outboard motor and go, wow, that came about by accident. And they even came with labels. Cool. That was a Yamaha, and that was a Suzuki, and that was a Kawasaki. Nobody looks at that and says it came about by accident, yet we look at the bacterial flagellum and says that it developed by accident without any kind of intelligence involved. It's mind-boggling. Another example is the blood clotting cascade. This is an amazingly complex system in nature that is an effective illustration of an irreducibly complex system. In his book, Michael Behe devotes an entire chapter to this wondrously complex system. I'm going to try to sum it up in the process, sum up the whole process in an effort to provide a bit more simple perspective, because I don't think you want me to hear me read a whole chapter of Michael Behe's book. But here it goes. The process of blood clotting begins with the everyday wound, a scratch, paper cut, scraped knee, cut incurred while shaving, whatever. And then without the blood clotting process, first of all, everyday injuries as these would literally cause you to bleed to death. Okay? Obviously, you work in a surgery, in an operating room, right? It's pretty important if people don't stop bleeding. So you got to have that blood cascade to be able to seal up these wounds. So After the point of initial contact or the point of initial injury, a protein complex found in blood plasma called fibrinogen begins to form a network of fibrous connections. This in itself does not stop the bleeding. The fibrinogen, and I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, is a composite of six protein chains containing twin pairs of three different proteins. It is a rod-shaped molecule with two round bumps on each end and a single round bump in the middle. So think of it as a set of barbells with an extra set of weights in the middle. So it's kind of a three-shaped thing, okay? There are three bulges on it. Normally, it is dissolved in blood plasma like salt in the ocean, okay? But when a cut occurs and bleeding begins, another protein trims those molecules, revealing sticky ends that bond to other molecules. It's pretty amazing. It forms an initial mesh over the wound that then begins to trap red blood cells. Think of it basically like a net. So the little components, the little fibrinogen that's in your blood, that's normally dissolved in your blood, once you get a cut, basically another protein comes, trims off the ends of the barbells so that they're sticky, and they stick to each other, and they stick to the skin on either side, the tissue on either side, and they form a net that starts to capture red blood cells. Okay? So, this process is regulated by two other proteins, without which the process of blood clotting would run rampant and would kill you. So not only do you have to have something that will start it, but you have to have something that will stop it at the proper time, because if you don't have either one of those, you'll die. Okay? So after the initial bleeding and the simple clot is formed, several more proteins are activated and regulate the clotting process to keep all the blood in the body from clumping together, blocking vessels, and causing death. So again, you get a cut on your finger, it's not like your knee starts to clot up. It clots where you cut, because there's a protein that says, hey, I'm exposed to air, I better make sure that I start clotting here. Right? And all that came about by accident, no intelligence at all. Anyway, so the clot framework is strengthened by another regulated protein process, and the clot eventually hardens. Once the clot is hardened, the entire clotting system is shut down, and other intricate systems are initiated to begin the healing process. This process is nothing new to us, and it's often overlooked as a simple process. However, biochemical investigation has shown that this process is, in fact, extremely complex. Intricately woven systems consisting of many independent protein parts. The absence of or significant defects in any one of the number of components causes the system to fail. Blood does not clot at the proper time if there's problems, or it doesn't clot in the proper place, and natural selection can offer no argument, no explanation for this. Okay? So if there's a problem, blood either doesn't clot at the proper time or the proper place, and the unfortunate organism either bleeds to death or is killed when all the body's blood supply clots. Big deal. Okay? As a matter of fact, if an organism has an issue with blood clotting in utero, it never makes it out. At least not alive. Okay? So, again, evolution by random mutations and natural selection cannot offer any method of creation of these systems, much less account for the many mistakes that would have been made along the way. So, if this system is irreducibly complex and all those things that are involved in it, all these factors that are involved in starting the blood clotting process and having all the right components there and then shutting it off at the right time and forming the harder shell and catching the blood cells and then shutting it off, all those pieces, if they had not been developed exactly as they are, the organism never would have made it to that point. It's not like you can have a partial process and then add on components as you go. It has to be complete. In the organism never makes it. Okay? So there is no answer for this in the naturalistic explanation. So here's another, the same thing we were talking about, but a little bit better illustration of it. So if you want, of course, all these slides are pretty much on the internet, they're older versions, but I mean, it's pretty straightforward. All right, another one we're going to talk about is the bombardier beetle. The bombardier beetle squirts a lethal mixture of hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide into the face of its enemy. The beetle has two special chambers in its abdomen that store the two chemicals safely apart from one another. The linings of these chambers contain a special chemical inhibitor. So, you have a bombardier beetle, and I'll go back up one just for a second. You can see that it's, you can see the little tweezers down there on the left one, where he's basically poking the dude in the leg, and the bombardier beetle sprays this chemical on the tweezers. And notice that on the other picture, he's spraying directly behind him. He can also spray in front of him. Goes right underneath him. Okay? So these little bombardier beetles are pretty interesting because they have these two chambers in their abdomens that store these chemicals. So the beetle, with these two special chambers, have this line, the chambers have these linings that have a special chemical inhibitor. Without the inhibitor, these two chemicals, when mixed together, they literally explode. So, in order to store them inside the body, the bombardier beetle has evolved a chemical inhibitor to make them harmless. Okay? At the moment the beetle squirts the liquid out of its tail, an anti-inhibitor is added to make the mixture explosive once again. Okay? The chain of events that could have led to the evolution of such a complex, coordinated, and subtle process is beyond biological explanation on a simple step-by-step basis. The slightest alteration in the chemical balance would result immediately in a race of exploding beetles. You realize that without the chemical inhibitor in there, that beetle would literally explode the second it tried to spray it out. Because guess what would happen? The chemicals, it's like fuel in a... Where's John Moransic? He's not here. It's like fuel in a gas can. You take a gas can and you go up to a campfire and you go like this, that's a really bad idea, because what's that fuel going to do? It's going to go right up the spout and into the can, and the can's on fire and you're probably on fire too. It's exactly what's going to happen in this case. It'll start a chemical cascade and the beetle would literally pop. So, an amazingly complex little beetle. Again, a great illustration of an irreducibly complex system. So let's talk a little bit about a probability. And remember, we talked about some of the details of DNA earlier, but with all we've learned in connection with DNA and the many intricate processes associated with life and the questions surrounding the evolutionary stance on how it all began, it's useful to illustrate a probability associated with the random generation of just one component of life, a single rung on the DNA strand. So if you look at the C and the G kind of there in the center with the one that has a label of a hydrogen bond, just the probability of one of those rungs happening by accident or coming about without organization. It's a very large number. It's 1 in 10 to the 87th power. That's a 10 with 87 zeros behind it. There are 10 to the 25th seconds in 4.5 billion years, supposedly how long the Earth has been around. That's a 10 with 25 zeros. The mathematical equivalent of an impossibility is 10 to the 52nd or more. So mathematicians actually put a number on impossible. It's not zero. It's a chance, one in a 10 to the 52nd chances. Okay? So they actually put a number on it. So it's 10 to the 87th power of just one of those rungs happening by accident. Just one. This comes from Dr. Wilder in those Origins videos. But anyway, Gene Wilder, I think it wasn't Gene Wilder, was it? No, he's the actor. What was his name? Oh, shoot, I just forgot. Dr. Wilder, you sniffed. Yeah, thank you. Not Gene Wilder. Correct. And there are many thousands, usually, of nucleotides, which is one of those connectors, one of the rungs in each gene. So, doing some simple math off of these would show that if an attempt were made to create just one rung per second, it would take more than 7 billion years to create just one rung by accident. And that says nothing to the effect of, or to answer where the components came from and the instructions came from in the first place. So even if the components were there and the instructions were there and the call it the matrix was there for that to happen, the components would take 7 billion years to form one rung. So, how about the probability of random protein creation? Because after all, that's what DNA does. It creates proteins. So, one chance in 100,000 trillion, 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 trillion. That's the probability of one protein being randomly created. Remember, the 10 to the 52nd power is considered mathematically impossible. So, more simply put, it's 1 in 10 to the 125th power, 125 zeros behind it. And there are between 300 and 500 protein molecules needed to create a minimally complex cell. So, in other words, you take that number, one chance, the 100,000 trillion, blah, 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 and multiply it by 300. And that's the probability of enough proteins being created for the most simple cell. The most minimally complex cell. So, just in the math alone, I think it's pretty obvious to see that irreducible complexity punches a hole, a very large hole, in the theory of evolution. At the molecular level, it's impossible. It is. Yet, again, it's accepted as being fact. And one of the reasons for that, one of the reasons that science will give, is that they say, well, we don't know everything yet. Well, I would agree that you don't know everything. But what you do know leads you, any logical person, to the conclusion that this didn't happen by accident.